Now, to return to the first reading, the scripture passage, clearly Paul was not a happy camper. Any paragraph of a letter that begins with, "Now in the following instructions, I do not commend you," and ends with, "Well, what should I say to you? Should I commend you in this matter? I do not." That's a letter I would not care to receive. Although I was in the ministry for over 39 years, so you can imagine I probably did receive a few of those. But Paul had founded this church in Corinth, had gathered the congregation, and moved on to start some more. He kept in touch through letters. And what we have in 1 Corinthians is one side of the correspondence. We don't know what they wrote to him. All we have is him answering them, some answering their questions, telling them what he has heard from others in that church and what he thinks about it. And so apparently they had allowed their observation of the Lord's Supper to denigrate from a sacred feast into a kind of free-for-all, void of any kind of communal activity or awareness of the holy. People just showing up, gorging themselves, even getting drunk, not thinking about those who might come after them and be left hungry. He was horrified. He gave them the equivalent of a trip behind the woodshed. Now, we don't know if this rhetorical dressing down ever did any good, if the Corinthians changed their ways, if their table manners improved, they began treating the feast and each other with a little more dignity, in the manner of and mindfulness of Thich Nhat Hanh's poem. What I wonder is if Paul might have something to say to us about our own eating habits, our own ways of sharing meals, which is supposed to be modeled on communion, something joyous and healthy and sustaining, full of spiritual, social, nutritional, and political dimensions. For these are present not only in our everyday eating habits, but also at this table. The traditional liturgy recalls the sacrament's origin. On the night he was betrayed, as Paul put it, when Jesus took bread and blessed it and broke it and gave it to his friends, saying, "Take and eat, this is my body broken for you. Do this in remembrance of me." This is actually the earliest account we have. These letters of Paul predate the writing of the Gospels, so this is the earliest account we have of this. And traditionally, it celebrates what's called the atonement, that is, Christ giving his life for us, his body broken on the cross, as the bread is broken at the table. And as we remember that, he is present with us. Now, at our own dinner tables, we are reminded that life feeds on life. Something had to die for us to live. Emerson once wrote, "You have just dined, and however scrupulously the slaughterhouse is concealed in the graceful distance of miles, there is complicity." Or as John Fife, some of you know John Fife, retired Presbyterian pastor here in Tucson, apparently he once remarked at yet another church potluck, "Whenever Presbyterians gather, a chicken is sacrificed." And so whenever we sit down to eat, we do well to remember all that went into making the meals possible, that somehow the farmer, the rancher, the truck driver, the migrant worker, the grocer, even the chicken, and maybe even the chicken's mother, are all present and somehow gathered with us. And so is the Spirit of God, the giver of all life. When we eat at this table or at our dinner tables, we do so in the context of such giving and such sacrifice. But we also need to remember, as Paul pointed out here, that communion is communal. There's no such thing as a private communion. This meal, in fact, all meals are really meant to be shared if possible. Did you know that 1 out of 5 American meals are now eaten in cars? And there's another huge chunk eaten at desks. I've been guilty of all that, I confess. But can you imagine the French or the Italians ever celebrating that, ever wanting to dine alone? They wouldn't. And there's no, you know, this isn't a good feature of our culture, because our culture often encourages consumption over communion. And there is no record of Jesus ever eating alone. fact, he didn't seem to be too picky in his choice of dinner companions. He had friends in low places. He was called a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. So his table was open to everybody. Sinners, outcasts, tax collectors, prostitutes, the unclean and the undeserving. This is what the realm of God looks like, he said. Full of people you don't expect to be there. Which I'm really grateful for, because that means that you and I are probably going to get to be there too. And while I often think of hell as one endless cocktail party, heaven may be a dinner party, a banquet, or maybe a Sunday picnic, but with all kinds of interesting guests and fascinating conversation with people of all stripes and colors and classes, maybe a fiesta. And that's why this church practices open communion, where you don't have to be a member or profess any kind of orthodoxy, because that's the kind of dinner parties that Jesus had. And I think it's a foretaste of the kingdom of God. No matter who you are or where you are on life's journey, we like to say, you are welcome. Because it's communion, it's not consumption. Now, those of us with inquiring minds or too much time might wonder about what Jesus was eating. What was his diet like? You know, the Jews had laws about what they could and they could not eat. It was called keeping kosher. In reality, Jesus and those of his peasant class likely didn't really have much choice in the matter. There was a New Testament scholar by the name of Eric Eve from Oxford. He said, the staple diet of a Mediterranean peasant in Jesus' day would have been bread. Around the Sea of Galilee, fish would also have been significant, though for peasants, perhaps only in small quantities. Grapes and olives were grown in Galilee, but more as cash crops for the wine and the oil trade than for peasant consumption. Food was probably scarce. Many probably went hungry much of the time or achieved only bare subsistence. But, he also says, I can't imagine many modern Americans taking enthusiastically to all the features of a biblical diet. For example, Leviticus 11:22 says, of them you may eat the locust, according to its kind, the bald locust, according to its kind, the cricket, according to its kind, and the grasshopper, according to its kind. Sounds really appetizing, right? Then there was a Florida physician who researched the whole matter, and he suggested that Jesus' diet was just simple and healthful. He said it was what we would call a Mediterranean diet now. And he said that if we want to live longer and healthier lives, we'll emulate that. That is, limit meat and sugar, and kind of be like Michael Pollan, who once wrote, if it comes from a plant, eat it. If it was made in a plant, don't. Easy to remember. Now, this doctor does not suggest locusts or grasshoppers, although, you know, I've heard that some people actually like them. But he says, I tell people, sure, you can continue eating the way you do. All the sugar and cake and pies and cookies and Snickers bars and fried foods, and you'll still go to heaven. In fact, you'll just get there a lot sooner. Now, I know paying attention to what we eat is perhaps a luxury when so much of the world doesn't have a choice and often goes hungry. It's a privilege we have, but perhaps it's also a religious duty because we do have so many choices. You know, the health of our planet depends upon it. You know, I enjoy a good steak as much as anyone, but I also know how much precious water has to be diverted to produce that steak. Also, the health of our planet and the health of our bodies depends upon the way we eat, mindful kind of eating. For instance, when I was 39 years old, just a few months ago, right, I had a kidney stone. And so I went to the doctor for the first time in a while to find out what shape I was really in. And he did some tests, and he gave me a list of foods I should avoid that promote kidney stones. Well, the tests revealed that my cholesterol was borderline high, so he gave me a second list of foods to avoid. that promote high cholesterol. And then we discussed some headaches I was having, and I got a third list of foods that tend to trigger headaches, and by then there just wasn't much left to eat. I think it was lettuce and kale. Broccoli. I don't think kale was a thing back then, but broccoli. So I ended up writing a song about it, The Non-Smoking, Teetotaling, Decaffeinated Vegetarian. Try to find 15 things that rhyme with vegetarian. And if you ever decide you want to resurrect the Pickin' Pastors and bring us back, I will sing that song for you. There's actually a couple of us left here in this church. But I have discovered over the years that I can eat anything I want, pretty much in moderation, as long as it is as basic as possible. And so rather than buy processed or packaged foods, I attempt to be a locavore. How many of you are locavores? Do you even know what a locavore is? Right. Somebody who tries to eat as close to the source as possible. And that is, so if I can't grow it myself organically, and by the way, you saw that slide at the very beginning of all those fruits and vegetables on a counter. That was from my garden. Unfortunately, it was my garden in Reno, so I don't think my garden in Tucson is going to do quite as well as that. But I tried that for several years, and I do have a garden here too. But if you can't do that, then I'll try to go out and find a you-pick farm. Or if I can't do that, I'll buy it at a farmer's market where I can talk to the farmer about, you know, how did this stuff get grown and where did it come from? And failing that, I'll at least shop at a grocery store that promises happy chickens, as my niece likes to call them. That is, chickens that lived a carefree life in the open, hormone, antibiotic, and chemical-free, and then has some produce that kind of matches that as well. You can't be perfect about it. It is a quest. Many of you remember, maybe you even knew, Barbara Kingsolver, who was a Tucson resident for many years, and about 10 or 12 years ago decided to leave for some unknown reason and went back to live on a farm with her family in Virginia. And so she wrote a book about that called Animal Vegetable Miracle. And it's about her family's quest to eat as locally as possible. During a one-year period, they ate seasonally, consuming foods only as they became available in their own garden or from the neighboring farms. And if you think convincing the kids they were never going to get a fast food hamburger for a year, it's tough, but they did it. They got together and did it. And so it was all about, she said, they get the food from the garden or from the farms. Said it told the story of what we learned or didn't, what we ate or couldn't, and how our family was changed by 1 year of deliberately eating food produced in the same place where we worked, loved our neighbors, drank the water, and breathed the air. Our highest shopping goal, she explains, was to get our food from so close to home that we'd know the person who grew it. And such food, she reports, is much tastier and healthier than what you can buy in the local supermarket. Some of you may subscribe or read Edible magazine. This just came out Friday. How many of you have seen Edible? You can get it at Whole Foods and some of the nurseries and things. I recommend getting this and don't just pick up the free copy. Subscribe to it and help them out. It's edited by Megan Kimball. She also wrote a book about being a locavore. She calls it Unprocessed, my city-dwelling year of reclaiming real food. Is trying to do the same thing right here. And so she tells that story. And I recommend that as reading for aspiring locavores. But it is at this point that the act of eating moves from the communal to the nutritional to the political. And it becomes such when you realize first that the average food item on your dinner table has traveled 1,500 miles to get there, using even more fossil fuel than was used to grow it in the first place. Now, I like blueberries and salmon and bananas. They're supposed to be good for you. But I try to limit, though, those kinds of things. Or when you look at all the jurisdictions in recent years that have banned artificial trans fats in restaurants or taxed sugar in soft drinks, things which promote cardiovascular disease and childhood diabetes, because, you know, the health of the community affects all of us, doesn't it? And then there's the larger picture, which is that many of our food choices are determined, actually, by national policy. Have you ever heard of the Farm Bill? Farm Bill has to get reauthorized every 5 years so the government can say, we're going to pay you to grow this and we're going to pay you not to grow this. And kind of works out that way. Well, Michael Pollan, who wrote The Omnivore's Dilemma, anybody read The Omnivore's Dilemma? That's another good one to do. Get a lot of summer reading, you say you can do today or get started on. He points out that the federal government urges us to eat more fruits and vegetables on the one hand, but on the other offers virtually no assistance to fruit and vegetable growers. They also put a lot of hurdles in the way of organic growers, while subsidizing the cheap supply of processed corn and soybean-based carbohydrates and fats that dominate the menus of our school lunch programs and fast food chains. It's no coincidence that being overfed but undernourished is an American problem. It's directly related to farm and nutrition policies, which have led to the demise of the family farm. Did you know that there are more farmers in the United States over 75 years of age than under 35? Kind of like the ministry. Same, very similar in many ways. But these policies lead to the demise of the family farm and also in what's called an agricultural monoculture. That is, in place of crop rotation, they plant one crop. Instead of rotating the crops, they just plant one, and then they over-fertilize the soil, and then which the changing crops would have done on its own, and plant another one. We now have 30% of the farmland in our country no longer arable. Then you even have some Midwestern states that have some of the most incredible deep and fertile topsoil in the world. These states need to import food because they cannot feed their population on number two field corn and soybeans. I remember going through Iowa some years ago, and all it was corn and soybeans. I thought, where are all the other things that people have to eat? You go to the grocery store and try to find a fresh vegetable. Hard to do. But so there's one more battle to fight. And do I even dare mention the word Monsanto? Well, I think today, kinds of things that Paul was addressing in his letter to the Corinthians would finally have to encompass all of these issues, you know, because it's not just about a mystical ritual that Christians practice on Sunday morning. You know, the Bible may have a lot to say about food and about dietary laws, but it is even more concerned with justice for the least of these, for the wholeness of God's creation. God's real concern is not the fasts or the festivals or how we perform a ritual like communion, but whether or not food is being shared with the hungry and caring for the homeless and the poor. Our national farm policies may have been designed in the Green Revolution of the 70s with the intention of providing abundant food for the world, and in large measure they have done that, but they've also resulted in making healthy food relatively expensive and unhealthy food cheap, and often the only affordable option for the poor. We have the luxury of eating well, most of us, and maybe also the duty, because by eating well, that is, eating food that is healthy and local, we resist a system of industrial agriculture, and we begin to change things. May not seem like much, but as Margaret Mead reminds us, never doubt that a small group of thoughtful, committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it is the only thing that ever has. Well, I hope I haven't spoiled your lunch. But these are the kind of things we're invited to consider whenever we sit down at table, whether it's the Lord's table or the one in our own kitchen. So read Barbara Kingsolver, read Megan Kimball, subscribe to this magazine, Edible Baja. Read it all alongside the Bible. Become a local locavore as much as possible. Plant a garden. Support the food bank. Try to have some effect upon policy. Make a place for Jesus at your table. And this morning, as we share communion together, let's remember. Remember the life that was sacrificed that we might have life. Remember those the world over with whom we share the table. Remember that while we are what we eat, even more we are how we eat and with whom. Gather round the table and remember in that spirit. Let's eat.